previously on Off the Wall.
Now, Greg, we are going to Alaska with you in this RV because you're doing something that some people might describe as crazy.
This particular ultramarathon is 135 miles.
We are going to be the crew, meaning we will be in this RV while you're running or walking the 135 miles.
I'm surprised at how lively and awake we are after 24 straight hours of doing this.
But while you're on that pinball road that, like, bounces the whole RV all around,
it is like pinball. It's exactly like pinball, except you're the ball.
I'm just trying to, like, make sure we're, like, sustaining Greg first and then getting some snacks in. I promise some coffee. I'm pushing that. Kind of like when you're on, like, a long-distance flight. Like, the breakfast and the meals are they're sort of reminders of time, but...
I had something to say, but I forget what it was. I really... I'm sorry about this. It's just we've been up so long. Well, I guess we'll just have to see how things go, right? So we're here at the finish line of the Denali 135, and we're all here waiting for Greg to arrive. He's about 3 miles out, I think, which means he'll probably be about another hour or so, I think. But it's really interesting. It's so informal. There's just a small group of people here that cheer on anybody who crosses the finish line. And that can occur pretty much at any time. I'm not sure how it works when it happens at 4 a.m. Maybe it's a very lonely crossing, I don't know. But one thing is for sure, Greg is going to finish. He's going to actually finish the 135 miles that he has either jogged or walked within 2 days. And that's the most amazing part. It's what time is it right now? It's only 4:25. Now this thing goes until 5 a.m. on Thursday. It's 4:25 on Wednesday, so he actually is finishing that much earlier. I honestly didn't think he was going to finish the whole thing. I thought it was going to do a lot of it, but I didn't think he'd make it all the way to the end. But I underestimated him, and I underestimated other people, too. And by the way, the reason I am stuttering and slurring my speech, I haven't slept yet. I've been up for a few days. Hey. And, so it's just you can see how people in an event like this get completely disoriented. And it's almost funny how people start to express themselves. So, Greg is no exception. Greg obviously has been running for 2 days now, almost. So it's going to be really interesting to talk to him after he arrives at the finish line. I don't think he realizes how many people are at the finish line. About a dozen people here. They're all involved in one way or another with this organization that puts on the Denali 135. And right now we're under a tent where it's raining. It's been raining the whole time, pretty much, much to Greg's chagrin, who is not a big fan of running in the rain. But you know what? I think when he arrives here, he'll feel it was worth it.
Oh, so totally worth it. This has been something he committed to, planned for, and has just put one foot after the other to complete. And here we are. I can't even believe we're here. I thought there was going to be some more stops, and I even joined in. I started walking with him, which was something that was recommended. It's something that you do at an end of a long race like this to help keep people on pace and to make sure that they're okay and that they have company when they're under sort of this extreme stress and fatigue. So I had a really good time just chatting with him, talking about errant things and checking in with him. But it was something I wish I had spent a little bit more time on. But as a support person, you have a lot of responsibilities to make sure he's set when he is taking breaks, when he's coming through, and you know, attending to whatever he needs in those moments. So it takes a lot out of you, and I'm just so happy that he's okay and that there were no like injuries or crazy encounters with wildlife or any calamity other than the rain. And he planned and again like anticipated enough that I think like he was comfortable and found the right combination of equipment and everything to set him up to complete the race. So I'm really, really amazed that we're here. And as you said, a little bit delirious, kind of bonkers from staying up and doing logistics and being in a rhythm with him and supporting him in this athletic feat.
Yeah, it really, you can't really describe it adequately, I don't think, because it's such a whirlwind of activity that takes place over a couple of days, but it means so much. And to get involved in something of this magnitude, imagine just running 135 miles, or running and walking 135 miles over the course of 48 hours, is just something that I wouldn't even think it was humanly possible. But I've been proven wrong. Of course, you know, it's not like the New York City Marathon. I think only 13 people registered for this particular race. There were other races going on at the same time. There was a 100 kilometer. I think there was a 50 kilometer. So it was a hotbed of activity on the Denali Highway. It's just something that it's, I don't want to say it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but it's definitely a unique opportunity in many people's lifetimes. And I think probably that is what makes something like this so alluring, you know? It's like Alaska is alluring. It's different. It's wild. It's untethered, you know? And it's just something that you feel the need to explore. I kind of get it.
Oh, I totally get it. I mean, with activities I've been interested in, like cycling and so forth, that you do long distances, and people that hear about it think you're crazy, but you really just plan and pack and travel in a different way, but you can totally accomplish this kind of stuff. But it's an undertaking, and you really have to train for it and be passionate about just wandering and taking in a route like this.
And again, we didn't plan on being up the whole time. Our original plan was to basically take shifts. One of us would sleep while the other worked, and vice versa. So it just wound up that we didn't want to miss anything. And if Greg was going to be up that whole time, then we should be up that whole time as well. I did the driving of the RV, which was definitely a unique experience, especially today when it decided that the battery was dead for no reason at all. And then all of a sudden it wasn't. Little things like that where, all you know, it's a major calamity. You don't know what's going to happen next, how you're going to get out of it. But you do. You figure it out. And here we are. So, I don't know what to say next. I'm so delirious at this point. So, anyway, we're waiting for Greg to show up, and I think that's where we'll pick it up, where he is crossing the finish line and what has to be a great feeling after doing something like this. I know it hurts like hell. I know he was tired. He took a half-hour nap at one point today. And it's funny because he did that, and we were waiting for him to do that, and I immediately fell asleep for 5 minutes. But I woke up, and I was by this this river, and this is true. I really, because we were parked there, and there was this river, and I had no idea where I was. I just could not figure it out. I was that out of touch, and just so fatigued that I didn't know why I was where I was. It was kind of cool. It's kind of cool not having any idea at that particular moment. I figured it out soon. And the other funny thing is the RV that we are driving, it's very unique because it comes from the Yukon. It's a Canadian RV. It's from 1981. And the brand name, for some reason, is Security. So people somehow think that we're Security. Believe me, this is not anything we planned. When we were parked by that particular lake, people were driving up to the lake to admire it, or the river. I don't know if it was a river or a lake. It had a current, so I guess that makes it a river. All right, so they drove up to the river, and then they saw the van, or the RV that said Security, and they drove away because they assumed they weren't supposed to be there because Security was there. I don't get it. I don't understand that mentality at all, but I also don't understand why a company that makes RVs would be named Security. But that's part of the whole experience. We saw all kinds of weird-ass names of RVs, and there's a whole culture there. So that is, it was fascinating to be a part of that for a few days. Of course, we still have to make it all the way back to Whitehorse.
Yeah, indeed. And the, I don't know, the entire RV experience itself was edifying. I don't know if I'm quite indoctrinated into the culture, but
you waved at every RV that passed by. I think you're indoctrinated enough.
Well, I did like the reactions, and it's such an unusual manufacturer name with odd implications and quintessentially Canadian, right? Only something like that could, you know, be an actual brand, and no one would, like, cast it aside or say it's a bad idea. It just makes total sense. But I've learned a lot, and I don't know. I'm in this state. I don't know if I can draw any conclusions yet.
It's hard to come up with the words, isn't it? You've been up for not wait. We can't even say it's 48 hours anymore. It's more than that. And don't forget the night before when we were told we had to be up at 4 in the morning the next day. We didn't get very much sleep because we couldn't go to sleep at 8 in the evening. So we're running on fumes here. But
yeah.
The end is in sight. As soon as Greg crosses that finish line, we can start getting back to a normal life and hopefully get 2 full nights sleep in one.
Yeah, I don't know how we did it. I can't even say how we did it. It was so complex and crazy and fun at the same time. And supporting a friend, supporting someone else, making sure they had everything they need, and seeing them have this tremendous achievement in their life and being a part of helping that, that's the once-in-a-lifetime thing I'm getting. More, I think, than the locale and terrain and natural beauty. I do love it. I love seeing the interior here, but to help somebody like this is really, I think,
standing out in the overall experience. And of course, the running community. I did a lot of track and field and cross country and then cycling. So I love the endurance and like long distance travel. Much in the way we often talk about our long distance travels. It's interesting. It's complex. It has fatigue and trials and tribulation and mishap, but it is how you have stories and adventures to share with others.
Well, I think we should check in with Greg and see how close he is to the finish line. Hand me that radio there. This is a hotline to Greg. I'm going to call him. Hey, Greg, how close do you think you are to the finish line?
What, mile? Finish line, is that?
Around the mile, you say?
Around the mile, 132, 3, line.
Can't really make him out, but I think he's getting close. Okay, well, we're looking forward to seeing you in a few minutes.
Well, I'm getting mile 129, so I think I probably have a good 20 to 35 minutes left.
129, I think we're at 131.
Yeah.
Do we know what mile this is? What mile is this?
What mile?
Yeah.
Oh, actually, not off the top of my head.
Because he's at 129 now.
Miles to the very end of the highway, maybe
it'd
have to be about.
Hmm.
I'm thinking this might be 131.
That's what I thought.
That's what I've heard.
Greg, I think the finish line is 131, so you're about 2 miles or less.
Yeah, cool. So, like I said, then, my way around, 40 minutes.
Okay, we'll see you then. So he's about a half hour out, and we'll pick things up then.
Yep, I see him. Here he comes.
You got him?
He's coming.
Greg has been spotted.
Yep, there he is.
You're right, there he is. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I hear he's rounding the corner.
Well, yeah, he's about, I don't know, what do you call that, half a mile down the road?
Yeah, I would say that's 3/4 or almost a mile.
All right. He's going to be very happy when he gets here.
Yeah, indeed. He's come a long, long way, and yeah, I see some activity around the corner. So there's somebody, and well, he'll be just trucking along, heading our way.
This is really historic, and you can only imagine what's going through Greg's head right now as he's finally finishing this 135 miles of combination running and walking over the course of less than 2 days.
Yeah, I'm just incredibly inspired and in awe of his ability and sharing this interest, this passion with us and letting us be a part of supporting, you know, something that really means something to him. And completing this is going to be something that we're going to talk about for a really long time, and I know he will be able to speak to as a harrowing, inclement as far as weather goes, but satisfying adventure.
Yeah, sometimes those are the most satisfying ones when the weather is terrible. I know we've done a 5-hour bike ride where it was pouring rain the whole time, and it felt great at the end. It didn't feel great during. But I hope for him it feels great at the end. I know that it meant a lot to him to have us around. You walked with him up some pretty big hills for a little while when he was really feeling tired. And just to have us here and to have all the support that he's been getting, it means so much. And I was telling him, when he went past, I think it was 105 4 miles, every step he took after that was a record for him, and that was the truth.
Absolutely. Like, the personal record and his own just achievement is what I'm just inspired and just moved to be more active. I wish I had participated in some of the walks with him more, but again, balancing support and then actively running and walking in this event is a tough task. So I'm just really blown away at being able to just be a small part in making it successful for him.
For those who keep track, the number of steps that he got from this activity is somewhere around 200,000. So, yeah, match that. All right, he's getting closer. They say he likes to sprint to the finish, so keep that in mind.
Ultra sprint and normal human sprint are two different things.
It's like mall walking.
Yeah.
Ultra sprint is like, I move my arms extra.
Extra.
That may be all we can hope to see.
Obviously, the physical toll here is awesome. No comparison, but lack of sleep with you guys. All the crew out there takes a toll, too.
Oh, yeah.
Lack of sleep.
Yeah. I forgot his name for a while.
Lack of sleep is hard on the body.
Here's God!
Woo! Run, Greg, run!
Here he comes.
Greg!
Here comes that sprint.
Come on, Greg!
Look at him go.
Here!
There you go! That was awesome.
Nice work.
Well, we're all caught up on our sleep, I think, 2 days after the race. Massive periods of us sleeping for two nights, actually, I think 12 hours each night. And I believe we're all refreshed as we start to head back towards Tok in Alaska, which will be our breakpoint for today. Right now we're in a place called Talkeetna, Alaska, which is an amazing town, just such incredible spirit and creativity and so many fun places to go. We hung out there. This is how it works in Alaska. For the race, we had the introduction meeting, and then the starting point wasn't right outside the door of the starting meeting. It was about 60 miles down the road. So we went there, and then, of course, there was a whole race, 135 miles after that. At the finish line, the party took place about, I think, over 100 miles away from there, and that's where we are now in Talkeetna, about to head out. Greg, how are you feeling after all of this activity?
Overall, I feel really good. I have a little enduring pain from some blisters on one of my feet. And otherwise, I'm okay. My legs were sore during the race, of course, and quite sore afterwards. Had a bit of a rough night's sleep with a little pain. Took some ibuprofen that seemed to do the trick. And after that, I'm fully recovered. I have probably a need for a little bit of a nap here and there. And I think I'm eating a little more than typical, especially yesterday when I ate an entire large pizza by myself. So I think I'm caught up on sleep mostly, caught up on calories mostly.
That was something to see. That pizza, it had a crowd at the end of it, but it was like, you went through the entire thing. It's completely understandable. But at the end of the race, that sprint of yours was something incredible to see. People were gasping at that because you're pretty much walking, maybe even hobbling, from a distance coming towards us, and then all of a sudden you just turned it on. The look in your eyes, it was really something to behold.
Yeah, I was really shuffling, I would say, for just about 30 miles. I was walking, and then what I discovered, I have a little tracker on my watch. What I discovered was I was going a little less than 3 miles an hour if I was walking, and a little more than 3 miles an hour if I was sort of trying to run, but not really making a lot of forward progress, you know, very small steps, because the body just starts to get very stiff and sore, and feet were sore, blisters, all that sort of thing. And I talked to the other racers. Everyone does that. You know, everyone does that. Maybe the top champions don't, but in a typical race, people go a lot more slowly at the end. And I do feel by the end of a race like this that there's nothing left. I've given it all, can't give any more. But I see that finish line, the people standing there, and I just love to go the extra little bit and actually push myself into a sprint for the last, I don't know, 50 yards, something like that. And it feels really good sprinting over the finish line, because this is all about conquering that inner voice that says that you can't do it, you don't have to do it, no one's forcing you to do this, you can go home, no one will mind, everything's fine. And you got to conquer that voice and say, well, yeah, actually, I think I want to do this, I want to finish it, I want to come through. And that sprint at the end, to me, is victory over that little voice in the back of your head.
Oh, that little voice must feel pretty bad now. I mean, I think you've probably conquered that voice for all time.
Yeah, well, people often tell themselves that something's too hard or something's too impossible, or they're not up for it, they're not trained enough, you know, they're not qualified enough, they don't know enough. And of course, sometimes you don't know as much as you need to, and sometimes you can't do stuff that genuinely happens. But a lot of times it's the voice that's trying to be really cautious against potentially hurting yourself. And if there's one thing I can tell you about ultra racing, it's all about the pain. You know, people are out there with some level of pain from maybe somewhere around mile 20. Maybe it doesn't set into around mile 30 or 40. If you're doing a marathon, maybe it sets in at mile 15. But it's all about saying, okay, yeah, it hurts, but is the pain important? Is it really stopping me? Or is it something that I can, you know, muscle through, continue on, and, you know, and in the end get to where I wanted to be? So, yeah, it's largely psychological, you know, physical, of course, you got to have the physical, but actually finishing these things is largely psychological.
So what would you say to people that are thinking of starting to get involved, maybe not 135 miles, but just a half marathon or a marathon or something like that, and perhaps they think they can't do it either?
Well, of course, I worked up to this as well. This is the longest race that I've done, and I last night I took a look at Facebook, and there's a new world record for the longest ever, what they call a backyard marathon, which is where you run every hour 4.17 miles, which means that in 24 hours you run 100 miles. So I get home to Facebook feeling really good about stuff. This is why you shouldn't look at Facebook, by the way. And there's a message that the world record has been broken. That this person ran over 400 miles with the short break in between 1 hour and the next, but 400 miles straight. Just incredible. So there's always something beyond, right? But if you want to start, you don't have to start with anything competitive. You don't have to start with any kind of marathon. Start by walking. You know, walk regularly. If you want to do a walk and then a partial run, that's great. You know, hop on an elliptical. If you're not into any of that sort of thing, then try swimming. Try team sports. You know, soccer is fantastic. If you're into sprinting especially, you're following that ball around. So anything is good from my point of view, just being active. But for people that want to maybe ease into running, the main thing is to start gradually. It is pretty easy to injure yourself. A lot of different parts can get injured, and some of those can be a long healing process. Some of the like Achilles tendon type of things, you get plantar fasciitis, there's all types of things that can occur, and that can sideline you for a little while. So take it easy, ease in, and then add distance as you can. And if you're interested in learning some techniques that people like, it's just like almost anything. There's a lot of people with a lot of different philosophies and learnings out there about how to run faster by alternating faster and slower, about how to run longer by integrating hill training, by integrating weight training also. Core strength is important to a lot of the races. But don't let any of that be daunting. If you're interested in just getting started, then that's I just said the key words, right? Get started. Get started by getting out of wherever you happen to be and doing something a little different, which might be a little bit of running, might be some running and walking, might be some sprinting. You might go on a track. You might go on a trail. You might go in your neighborhood. So there's a lot of possibilities. One thing I like about running is you don't need a whole lot. You need some reasonable sneakers. You know, don't let your sneakers get too old and ratty. That's bad for your feet and will often result in injuries. But otherwise, you don't need a lot of specialized equipment to get out there and start enjoying the outdoors. Or again, if you prefer, enjoy the track, enjoy the neighborhood that you're in.
Now, you have a rule where you always walk or run at least 1 mile a day, and that rule applied even after you did the 135 miles. I couldn't believe it. Yesterday you said, I've got to go now. I've got to go on my 1 mile. But that, I got to say, is really inspirational, because 1 mile is not that much. It's attainable if your feet are in decent condition. It's maybe about, 20 minutes or so, and you've done that. If you just do that in a day and do that every day, I think people will feel the effects of it, right?
Yeah, and a mile's 2,000 steps, you know, so in the scheme of things, you're probably walking 2,000 steps a day anyway, and so this simply takes the discipline of saying, okay, let's make sure I do it continuously or more or less continuously every day. So they call this a streak, a running streak or a walking streak, and there are people that do it for different distances. Some people want to do 5 miles running a day. Some people are happy with getting on a elliptical machine every day, but the whole point is to use that fact that you just did it for the last 10 days or 100 days or even 1,000 days, and say, let's use that to inspire me to make sure I actually do it today, instead of, again, listening to that little voice inside that says, you had a long day, why don't you just relax, just have dinner, watch some TV, you don't have to go. But getting into the habit means that you're sort of, if you don't go today, then you sort of sacrifice all those previously great accomplishments of several hundred days. Now, of course, 1 mile a day, as you say, it's not that ambitious, but believe me, a lot of days I just don't feel like doing that. And after having blisters on my feet and a sore knee and all this stuff after the 135, it would have been pretty easy to say maybe I'll just take the day off. But again, one mile, I can do it. Do it every day and enjoy it. And part of what I do for my particular streak, as I say, it's outdoors. So it can be running, can be walking, but it's outdoors. And getting outdoors is so important to mental health, mental well-being, in addition to the physical effort that you're putting in.
Well, Greg, this has been so inspirational, so much fun just to be a part of it. I'm so honored that you asked Kyle and myself to be part of the team. And I was kind of blown away by how much the team gets recognized at the end as well, as if we were marathoners too. And we're certainly not, but I know it's an essential part of the race to have a team behind you and ahead of you. And it was just great to be a part of that. Our adventures have continued. As I mentioned, we're in this place called Talkeetna. Kyle, Greg, any of your thoughts and impressions of this place?
Oh, it's really small and historic. It has a long history in outdoor and adventure. And being in a mountainous area, climbing is a big deal here. And I've learned a lot. They've got these tourist trains, too, that bring in a lot of visitors, the people that are interested in taking part in some of those activities and checking out some of the things that the town has to offer. And we walked around a lot. I mean, airports and bush airplanes are really important, because you have to go out to some of these base camps and further reaches in Alaska.
There's an airstrip right here in town, two airstrips. There's a grass airstrip. It's literally a block away, and occasionally a plane will fly very, very low overhead, a small plane, but still it's impressive.
Yeah, and just walking around, checking those out and seeing the different streets, walking by the headquarters for the ranger station, and seeing the other services and businesses here. There's a couple breweries, and I just was fascinated just looking around at some of the development and how things are kind of really far flung and kind of remote, but also tied into the overall infrastructure that we all enjoy in other cities and parts of the world.
Greg, what do you think of this place?
Well, I enjoy seeing all the historic buildings. We're next to a yurt, which probably isn't too historic, but it's a traditional type of building. We saw some of the old cabins, trapper cabin from 1913. I think, so that is still standing in historic interest. That's all pretty cool. And this is the place in Talkeetna where you launch your ascent of Mount Denali, which is a whole other discipline that I can't speak as much to as running. But if you're interested in climbing the tallest mountain in North America, this is where you have to start. And I believe what people do is they get their permits settled at the ranger station, and then they get on their plane at that grass strip and dropped off at the 7,000-foot base camp over on Mount McKinley, the tallest mountain in North America. And that's, I don't know, maybe it's about 100 miles from here, maybe a little bit longer than that, and you cannot drive to the base of the mountain, really, so you have to get there by plane.
You said Mount McKinley?
Yeah, Mount McKinley is the tallest mountain in North America. They sometimes call it Denali, and it's in a place called Denali National Park.
Hang on. Mount McKinley and Denali are the same?
Yeah, Denali is a traditional sort of native name, and of course, Americans like to think that they discover everything and own everything, so they called it Mount McKinley after the past president. And now you sort of hear both names used interchangeably, but the national park that it's in is called Denali National Park, and it's adjacent also to Denali State Park, town of Denali, so the native name actually tends to dominate the discourse.
Well, thanks for clearing that up. It was confusing me a bit, hearing the two names. So now I know they're one and the same, but Denali is the official name now, and that's a great thing. Any other impressions of this particular place, Talkeetna?
Well, it's a really friendly place, and sort of tourism and is dominant here and focused on giving people a good time, some interesting stuff to see, a lot of local crafts, that sort of thing. We did visit the local radio station, which was fascinating. This is an NPR affiliate, but they also have a lot of local programming, and that includes, as you imagine, local DJs doing their own thing. We met the woman who was doing a show called Songs That Make Me Happy, which was great because she's trying to choose songs that make her happy, not necessarily everyone else. And we talked to them a little bit about some of the radio stations back in New York and some of the programming that they could be interested in. So that was fun. A local station that has, as I said, an NPR affiliate, so it's syndicated stuff, but also a lot of local flavor, and I'd say that's what this is around here, a lot of local flavor.
And that particular radio station is inside a log cabin, just like almost everything here is built out of logs.
Yeah, it's great. The tradition is evident really everywhere you look here, and not everything is old, of course, but I think they try to keep that sort of rustic essence going.
Yeah, it's as you were speaking, we're sitting here on Main Street at a coffee shop, and this van filled with people, it said dog sled team or dog sled tours. So I guess there's some kind of a tour that's going out now.
Yeah, Dallas Seavey is a multiple world champion winner of the Iditarod, which is a big race in Alaska that goes from Anchorage, Alaska to Nome, Alaska every spring. And his dad, Mitch Seavey, was also a multi-time Iditarod champion. So they have a kennel, and I guess they do, which isn't too far away, and I guess they do tours where you can go and visit the kennel, meet the huskies, and actually, even though it's summertime, you're not on snow, but actually go out on a little ride on a cart with some dogs pulling you along. So that's a fantastic tourist experience.
Okay, we had to take a little break there because the mosquitoes were just going insane. Kyle, have you ever seen mosquitoes like this?
Well, the intensity. I think they have a ready source in tourists as they come through. So in the mornings, it's a little bit less. They're looking for anything, jonesing it, so to speak, to get their day started.
Well, I didn't realize this, but they can detect us. Like, we were in a cabin, and we had the window open, the screen was, of course, closed. But when we got up in the morning, there was a whole lot of mosquitoes just kind of waiting there on the screen. They detect our exhaling? Is that how they work?
Yeah, it's carbon dioxide primarily that they can sense. But Greg told me that there's also a heat-sensing aspect to their physiology.
Yeah, once they get closer, so carbon dioxide gets them in the neighborhood, and then once they get closer, they have a heat sensor, which lets them, find your actual skin and land on it. So if you're wearing bug dope, some sort of insect repellent, then that throws off the sensors and they're less likely to find you. However, if they do find you, if they stumble on you and land, then they're gonna go ahead and bite. So the bug spray is not an effective deterrent from them biting you, but it is effective from keeping them from finding you. And that's also part of why the bugs are so bad here, is it's relatively cool, not that sunny right now, and so that helps the bugs to use, and it's also not windy. So those different factors help the bugs to find us, and then once they get close, you can look around and you see them pretty well swarming around us here at the table.
It's really incredible and a bit frightening. It's the only negative thing about this place that I can think of. Ever since we've gotten here, every moment has been magical, from the visit to the NPR station to just walking around the street, looking at all the shops that are here, to just having dialogues with people. One thing that's kind of interesting, everybody says that this place is what the TV program Northern Exposure was based upon. And I looked it up on Wikipedia, and in fact, they said this was said by a journalist. And that was it. That was the only citation. But I went to the citation, and I just want to read you the part that is relevant to this. The article begins, Ask anybody in town. Talkeetna was the model for Sicily, Alaska, the quirky little town featured in the TV show Northern Exposure. If that's not true, it could have been. Literally, that's it. If that's not true, it could have been. That's a citation. Everybody bases their belief that this town was the inspiration for Sicily. Okay, fine. Tell yourselves whatever you want, but it's a neat, quirky little town, absolutely. But I don't know if it deserves that kind of credit. Any other memories of this place we want to take with us?
Well, we did see a moose. We saw some moose droppings, and I guess that has a tradition here in Talkeetna as well.
That's right. They had some kind of festival. Do you remember what it was called?
It was something like the Moose Dropping Festival of, I don't know, something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's call it the Moose Dropping Festival. They had that up until maybe 10 years ago. I'm not sure why they stopped it, but there was a controversy before that. I got this from Wikipedia, too, and I got to say, I sort of doubt that it's true, but maybe it is. Maybe we could do some more research. It basically involved moose droppings being dropped from helicopters. I think they were painted or something.
Yeah, so moose droppings are pellets. They're about the size of an acorn, and when mooses poo, when they eliminate, they'll leave a whole pile of these. So it looks almost like a squirrel, you know, couldn't get all of its 100 or so acorns back to its tree. And so they lie there on the ground, and I guess for this festival they would pick up the moose droppings, which are pretty dry and pretty firm, and shellac or coat them on the outside, give them a little gold coating, and then throw the moose droppings out of a helicopter.
Yes, it was a sort of performance art and public spectacle, I believe. And I think PETA got really upset. They thought the mooses were being harmed in some way, I think.
Well, that's the unbelievable part of this Wikipedia page. They say that there was a miscommunication, and that PETA, the animal rights people, somehow got the impression that entire moose... Is it mooses or moose? What's the plural of moose?
I intentionally misspoke. I think it's just moose.
Moose. I'm going to say moose.
Yeah,
it feels right.
Involved.
Yeah. So they thought that actual moose were being dropped out of helicopters. I don't know how anybody could get that impression. And it just seems so bizarre and unlikely that that kind of miscommunication could happen. And if you read on in the story, they say it took hours of angry phone calls and back and forth to get PETA to back down. It just seems like somebody is making this sound a whole lot more ridiculous than it possibly could have been, and I don't even think it happened in the first place, but maybe I'm wrong, maybe a listener can correct me. But regardless, the Moose Dropping Festival is no more for other reasons, I believe.
Yeah, it is kind of sad. I would say that the PETA is an organization that I have some sympathy with, being a long-time vegetarian vegan, but they just don't have much of a sense of humor, so I kind of believe this.
But you see, you're basically, if this is a fake story that was planted, it makes you want to say negative things about PETA. And I don't know. If they really believe this, I agree with you. If that's true, I agree with you. I just kind of doubt that it's really... It just seems so bizarre.
Yeah, so it could be a false flag operation of the moose-dropping conspiracy.
That's right. They got to take whatever you can get.
Yeah, it's interesting lore, and learning that is part of the interesting aspect of coming and visiting places like this. I always find interesting coffee places, and that's where we are now. We're at a place called Conscious Coffee. It's right on Main Street, I believe. Is that Main or East Main?
That's Main Street. That's Main Street. It's interesting that this place has a grid, so there's like a second street and a first street. And the streets continue even if something like an airfield gets in the way. On the other side of the airfield, then 2nd Street will continue. But everything is so walkable and easy to find, and the people are just so cool and friendly, and it's highly recommended. I would like to come here in the winter. I really would. I think there is some life here, and I'd like to take that train, too. There's a train that comes right through town between Fairbanks and Anchorage, and there are other trains, too, that go to different parts of Alaska. I believe Seward is one place that that trains go. So that's a whole network to explore.
Yeah, I can see why this is a leaping off point for many different kinds of adventures. I'd love to come back and visit it in a colder climate and just to compare and to get more familiar with it.
You know what's cool about coming here during a colder environment? I'll give you one guess, Kyle.
There's no mosquitoes.
You got it. There's no mosquitoes. So let's come here in the winter, and we won't have to worry. I'll even sit outside. I don't care, as long as there's no damn mosquitoes. And, boy, how many of them are at the table right now? About 20? It's insane. I have mosquito bites in places I never thought I'd get mosquito bites. So let's get in the RV and kill all the mosquitoes there. Kyle, you have the record, I think, for killing mosquitoes.
Yes, I have a little packet, like a travel pack of facial wipes for, beauty. It says gentle skin cleanser, and I've been bludgeoning mosquitoes quite effectively with that. But they're hemophage.
What does that mean? You keep saying that.
They're a species that lives on blood.
I think you're a species that lives on blood. I mean, the look of glee in your eye whenever time you get a hit.
It turns out not all hemophage are human. So, do with that what you will, but I'm ready to complete this task.
All right, well, we are going to be on our way. Kyle, you're going to be doing the bulk of the driving, I believe, on our way to Tok, T-O-K.
Yeah, and it's a place we've been before. We're going to stop there and camp and then continue on our way back to the Yukon.
That's right, across the border and then out to Whitehorse. And then we figure out what we're going to do after that.
Yeah, it's going to be a nice drive. I think hopefully we won't have as much rain and whatnot as we had in our last few days on the Denali Highway. And the road, by the way, I don't know if we talked about the road. The road is just amazingly terrible. You feel like you're not even in North America anymore. You're in some weird part of the world where the road's been bombed out and not maintained or who knows what, or it's an inhospitable border crossing. But in fact, it's just a section of the Alaska Highway between... the Alaska-Canadian Highway between Whitehorse and Alaska, and we're going to be bumbling along that for several hours later on today and tomorrow.
Well, actually, we're not going to the Canadian part today, so we have a couple of days to prepare for that. What we're doing now is going to Tok in Alaska, and I think the road is fairly okay for the most part. But yeah, the worst part I think was between Whitehorse and the border on the Canadian side, where it was I couldn't even stay in the back. It was so painful for me.
that was a section that I was interested in doing a bit of, and then I think you guys could be alternates for that leg after Greg crosses over.
Okay, well, we're dividing up the driving. Of course, Greg has just run 135 miles, so he deserves to rest as much as possible. But, Greg, I want to thank you so much for taking us on this journey and for inspiring our listeners. And what's the next challenge that you have on your agenda?
Well, I am running a 50-mile ultra in Whitehorse called the Reckless Raven. That's on July 9th, Sunday, so a couple weeks from today.
Oh, really? Already? You're running another one?
Well, I don't schedule these things, but I do sign up for them, and I think I'll be ready by then. I think my blisters will be healed, and I don't imagine I'll get much weaker or stronger, however much I decide to exercise between now and then. That doesn't require a crew, that race. There's it's more traditional with rest stations, where they have the Gatorade and that sort of thing, and that'll be, for me, probably about a 13 or 14-hour excursion through the wilds of Yukon.
And I heard somebody at the party yesterday mentioning a winter version of this race. Is that really a thing?
I think they're considering it, and it sounds like they would do it as on a test basis. But the thing about it, you like do it one year just as a test with a few people, which I think they did with the road race. The thing about it though is the road is not open, so it's open, but it's not maintained. It's not plowed beyond the very first bit. So what that means is that your support crew, assuming that you're going to have support crew, is going to be on snowmobiles, maybe possibly some other type of conveyance, but most likely snowmobiles, which by the way, in Alaska they call snow machines. So that adds a whole other level of complexity, because 135 miles on snow machine is non-trivial, and the snowmobilers themselves will have to have pretty substantial winter gear, you know, clothing. Often you'll have sort of a wall tent or some other sort of place that you can go inside and warm up a little bit, light fires, that sort of thing. So that's really a fairly serious expedition level outing. So I'd be very interested in what they do with that. There is something similar to that I run in Whitehorse, something called the Montane Yukon Arctic Ultra, and that's a race that is a marathon, which I did this past year, the year that they were in earlier this year, a marathon in February, or you can go on for a 100-miler or beyond.
Thank you. Sorry, we killed about 11 mosquitoes during what you were just saying, but I'm fascinated by all of this. I'm just wondering, how does the support team in a winter version carry all the supplies? You need a trailer behind your snowmobile, I would imagine, and if weather happens, you know, another storm or something like that, it's... You know what? Don't call us for that one. I don't think we're the right people.
Wait. That could be good.
Okay, explain how that could be good.
I mean, how complicated is a snowmobile? It's like a bicycle with, like, skis.
Do you remember the time when we tried to start the RV and for some reason the battery wasn't connecting and we thought we had a dead battery?
Yeah, and you jiggled the cables. That's all we need to know.
I jiggled the cables, but I don't think I can do that in a blizzard. I'm not sure I can do that in a blizzard. There was the other time we thought we were out of gas, all right? And there were so many times. In fact, we met somebody in this town that wasn't even at the race who recognized our RV because they happened to be driving on the Denali Highway. Had nothing to do with the race, but they recognized us here as, oh, you're that RV, and we saw you with your hood up. Were you broken? And like, well, we were concerned, and thanks for asking now, days afterwards. But it just goes to show what an impression you can make on people and how small a world it really is.
Yeah, with the winter travel, it's actually pretty different. I can tell you that in Alaska, the winters are so severe and the cold can get so life-threatening that people stop immediately. And in fact, it's a law that I don't think it's just a winter law. But if you're over on the side of the road with your hood up and someone just drives on by, they're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to stop and check on you, because you know people can die of exposure. And on some of these roads, it's not like a city where there's someone passing, there's someone else passing, and someone else passing. You might not see another car sometimes for hours at a time. So looking out for one another and being willing to help one another are part of the essence in Alaska, and also being well prepared. So with this race that we're talking about, the winter race, whether it's the one in Yukon or maybe a potential one on the Denali Highway, these snowmobiles are big, wide track, expedition grade snowmobiles. They're not little sport things that you would use just for recreation. They're meant for multi-day expedition travel, and there's a couple models, you know, of snowmobiles, you know, a couple of different brands that people have. And yeah, they're pulling a really quite a big sled, and that sled will have some gas. It'll have, as I mentioned, maybe a wall tent, maybe some wood to make a fire, obviously some first aid supplies, some various camping supplies, things like that. So they go out pretty well prepared. And also, and this is key, they don't go out alone. So this is an expedition. There'll be multiple snowmobiles. So if one snowmobile breaks down, then they can pick up the next, they can be picked up by the next snowmobile. And also, last thing to mention is how important clothing is. And we saw this with my race. I had to change clothing multiple times because of the rain. And I wasn't prepared for sub-freezing temperatures, but we got into the 40s with cold rain, and that was a pretty serious situation, actually, because you can really get hypothermia. That's like a perfect combination of conditions for hypothermia, because it's not that cold, but it's wet, and it's cold enough that when you're out for hour after hour, like I was, you can rapidly transition into teeth chattering and shivering and stuff like that. So anyway, for the winter expedition, what you're going to do is have a bunch of clothing. Make sure that clothing doesn't get wet at all. Like, you don't want to sweat in your clothing in the wintertime, because that'll stop the moisture and the air from wicking away, and also it will potentially freeze. That's how I ended up with some frostbite a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I imagine the crew side would be much more interdependent. I felt like we were independent in a lot of ways, just our vehicle. We would see other vehicles, and as you said, they may notice or not that we're part of the run and stuff. So, it just seemed like the type of thing that if we really did need help, people would recognize us and stop and talk and make sure we're okay.
Did you just have a couple of fans tap you on the shoulder here?
No, that was the winner. That was number one from the Denali race. They just came in, got their coffee, recognized us, and once again said congratulations, great seeing you, good luck for the future.
That was awesome. The amount of support and teamwork here is just incredible and so inspiring. So once again, Greg, thanks for including us on this, and we're going to make our way out of here now. This magical town and across Alaska to Tok, a place that we've been to already. It's always good to go back to a place you've already been to because you feel familiar with it, and it's sort of comforting. And we'll pick things up on a future show. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thanks, everyone.
Until next time.
This is the moment we'll remember every day for the rest of our lives. Time may rush us, hurt or love us, but on this day we have arrived. It's been a long time coming, we've been in the running for so long, but now we're on our way. Let the ride just take us side by side and make us see the world through new eyes every day. You're a winner, I'm a winner, this is all happening so fast. You're a winner, I'm a winner, let's enjoy it all while it lasts. I've been a loser, paid my dues, fought my way up from the ground. Now at this moment, the crowd acclaim us. You just listen to that sound. It's been a long time coming. We've been in the running for so long, but now we're on our way. Let's go ride, just take us side by side. Just to compete. Don't forget all the love and laughter.